In it a long time. We're kind of at a watershed moment in our expansion plans now. Our factories that we have in the U.S. at one point in their history were industry leading in terms of capacity. We're now looking to restructure our manufacturing footprint in preparation for the next stage of our growth. And all of our capacity today really should belong under one roof. And so I won't spend too much more time talking about that other than, you know, we're globally integrated. We've been in it a while. We invented multicrystalline technology many years ago. Multicrystalline technology is about 50% of the market today in terms of a substrate. We've been working with the DOE in a variety of manners for most of those years, and I think it's been an extremely successful relationship, and look forward to more of that. There's one product that we produce through those relationships that I think is critical to our future, and that's the graduation of new students for this business. So there are three pillars of incentives that we've come across through the history of the business. One is R&D. As I mentioned, we've been we're proud to be participants in the Solar America Initiative. We have over 12 to 14 partnerships in that program. One is with Dow Corning, as an example. We have other industry relationships. We work with IMEC. We're starting to work now with Applied. So we're a big believer in bringing a lot of good minds to solving some of our bigger problems in terms of how we manufacture things. The other two pillars of the chair, though, that support this industry and its future are the market incentives. I'll talk a little bit about my perspective of market incentives in the first few slides, a little bit about some of the R&D programs that we have underway and the challenges that we have in scaling them in this environment today. And then the third area is around manufacturing incentives. As I mentioned, we're in the process now of looking how we looking to optimize our manufacturing footprint. And the manufacturing incentives in China are pretty spectacular, where, as an example, for one of the technologies my team's been working on, we've been offered more or less free facilities with the infrastructure already supplied in an environment in an area where growth is essentially unlimited. And those are hard incentives to turn down. A little bit about the past, as I think it's always a good indication of things to be concerned about for the future. If we can learn something, most of the industry in its past has grown up in this off-grid market. And so, you know, around the 93 time frame, the Japanese incentives came to market. Those incentives really provided an exorbitant amount of growth for our industry at the time. What's happened, though, as the residential markets, I think someone said on the panel list earlier today that those incentives provided the birth of solar homes. As the solar home market was penetrated, a lot of the Japanese local market opportunity actually began to diminish. And as a result, of course, people began to look offshore. German incentives have been fantastic. They're really a critical part of the growth that we've seen through the early part of this decade. I think that if you look at what's happening now in terms of the incentive schemes, there were a lot of people making a lot of money in utility projects through the early parts of this decade. And the incentives today, though, are now being structured to favor the residential market. And I'm not a policy expert, but my reading of the tea leaves is that by looking at the residential market, more of the German community can participate in the growth of solar as opposed to just utilities. But utilities are critical to bringing us the scale we need for our cost curve advances forward. Spain came on. This is an interesting story. I think I have it right here. In 2008, if I'm not mistaken, according to Navigant, it looks as though Spain probably consumed most of the industry's output, a little over 2 gigawatts. In 2009, we're expecting something in the range of 300 megawatts. So in the space of a year, because of how they came to market, there was an enormous amount of capacity brought on. We now have this new market emerging in 09, where Spain might well just be a small part of the overall pie. And as a manufacturer, thinking about bringing on new capacity, new technologies, it's kind of hard to plan around that when all of a sudden the next year's capacity may in fact be capped and stranded. The good news in all of these, this is about the third or fourth time we've been through this in our history. We always end up with massive amounts of growth thereafter, primarily because of the changes in price points in the market. And we're already seeing now a rather substantial change in pricing going into 09. A little bit about jobs. When I speak of manufacturing or am asked questions about manufacturing, usually the intent's about jobs. From the Photovoltaic Industry Association in Europe, three of every four jobs, as Dick was saying earlier this morning, are really around the systems part of the business. And it actually is a lot larger than that if you begin thinking about all the ancillary jobs that are attached to making homes compatible with solar and procurement and all the other things that go into local planning. A little bit about jobs from another perspective. We see a lot of interest today in large utility projects. One large 100 megawatt utility project is around 200,000 homes. So you can start to see, if you're thinking of jobs, where the jobs are. 2-to-1 in terms of residential versus large project jobs. But there are different types of jobs, as you saw from the slides that Dick was using. Think about residential integration versus utility. My proposal is, as you'll see in one of the slides later, there's a way for us to bring in an even larger segment of industry into this space. Looking toward the future, though, in the U.S., if you believe in forecasts, I think forecasts are useful. You have to always take them with a grain of salt. But at the moment, it looks as though most of the incentives that are coming about, which I love, we love as an industry, are really driven by what we're familiar with. We have an opportunity to move into a turf that is perhaps new and more challenging. I'll come to that. A little bit about where we are. I hear a lot of talk about grid parity. If you look at 2008 as an example, most of the systems that were installed, especially in residential systems, were around $8 a watt. That before any rebate or incentives in sunny parts of the country or world, translates into energy costs around this level. The residential rates from a utility in PG&E during the peak hours of the day are that. So the math is starting to work, but this is a variable power supply. It's best at peak times of the day, and how we price and go to market should accommodate these kinds of opportunities, of course. Today, already, though, in terms of where we are in pricing for 09, we're starting to see sub-$4 a watt installation opportunities for crystalline products, thin film products. And you can imagine the impact. It won't be quite half this, but we're starting to get into rates that are competitive off the peak parts times of the day. A couple of slides about some of our technology challenges. We have a long history in the silicon part of the value chain. Won't spend too much time on this. One of the particular challenges that we're having, though, we have sort of two approaches that we've come up with now to extend the art beyond multicrystal technology. And there are two approaches, actually. In one case, one tool has over 40 times the capacity that the current tool sets have. Now, that's a wonderful thing. If you can plan on the future being there to actually utilize that capacity, it's a disaster if we go into this with 50% capacity utilization. It's a tough investment to sell to any investor. Where we cite this part of the value chain, as Hemlock was saying, or Eric was saying on behalf of Dow, you have some natural requirements in terms of where you cite different parts of the supply chain. Of course, if you're in this part of the business, you need to be somewhere close to low-cost energy, and being close to silicon is also very good. The technology I'm referring to, this is multicrystal. It was developed quite a few years ago now for solar cell processing. a big ingot of silicon cut into bricks, cut into wafers. These have turned into solar cells. Monocrystal has always had an efficiency advantage. We have a new technique now that we launched back in 06, have started to take into market now, and it, in effect, is a new way to grow a monocrystal so that it approaches the efficiencies of mono-CZ with the cost structure of multi. We're working with IMEC and others who have already achieved over 17% with pretty traditional technologies and are now looking at over 19 with some specialized cell processing. So you can see we're shifting the paradigm nicely. Here again, though, as I mentioned, in order to deploy this technology, we need a market that has some predictability to it, to the extent you can predict markets, at least in this case, though, the capital outlay to commercialize is quite high. You heard a little bit about cells. I'll skip a lot of this just in the interest of time. This is an area where a lot of folks don't normally think about R&D or development or new things that we can do to drive the cost down. But my opinion is over the last few years, we've probably had more success in this area than most any other part of our supply chain. Much of what you see today, you heard some commentary about quality. The design and standards for today's solar modules came from the United States early in its industry's life, and are the standards and certifications that are used, certification requirements for all products manufactured today. You can choose as a manufacturer to comply or not, but the groundwork for all of this came from the U.S. There's an opportunity now to move beyond that. We're, with these utility jobs, moving into a new world, a world of energy, not watts. It's no longer horsepower, the horsepower of your solar module. It's miles per gallon. It's kilowatt hours. And there is a lot of opportunity, both in terms of modeling, science, and the prediction and optimization of energy. Most markets today pay you for watts. We would like to begin being paid for kilowatt hours. And so ultimately, where you cite this type of technology, of course, is going to be driven by the market dynamics. If we import all of this at a gigawatt level, if we import modules into the States, the capital requirements, the working capital, just to float that kind of investment is pretty staggering. So you can think about the U.S. at a gigawatt. So there will be a natural migration of jobs, at least at this part of the supply chain, back to the U.S. as we bring scale on. And then just a couple of new technologies that are coming in this area that I can talk about. A lot of the programs you'll see today are making the solar modules more efficient. These are some that we have in-house, won't talk about. There are others, though, that have no bearing at all on watts, but do have a pretty sizable impact on energy. And if you look at all the things that we're working on now, it's about miles per gallon. Thermocool is a technique we filed for patents on last spring, and it will change the thermal characteristics of a module quite a bit, which is good for energy. But if a customer is only paying for watts or power, it's irrelevant. So we now need to move beyond watts into energy. Another example of some new circuitry that's coming out now, we've done a lot with circuit optimization in the solar array, circuit optimization in the solar module. Some of these that we've deployed in comparison to traditional techniques, we're seeing upwards of 28%. Some other studies have shown that the energy output for this type of circuitry actually exceeds 30%. So we're heading in the right ballpark, but again, here's an opportunity for us to begin thinking about industry incentives in a new way. I think if you look at the Petrosolar website as an example, the utility in New Jersey has now set up an opportunity for some of this new type of technology to be brought into their service territory in a very innovative way, and it's just a marvelous program. A little bit about systems, since this is where most of the people are employed. I put this up mainly because there's some natural characteristics of solar technologies. It's a variable output, but you can predict it on average. You can't necessarily predict, if you follow the weather forecasts, you can't predict any given hour, but over time you can be quite good at it. We have regularly delivered solar power systems that have, for the industrial folks in the crowd, 99.9 98% availability, which is a phenomenal statistic if you're in the power business. Can be deployed on either side of distribution. So in the smart grid sense, solar can, as a natural advantage, be used on the retail side of things and not add more current requirements, carrying capacity through our U.S. distribution now. And we're working now in Phoenix as an example. And one of the discussions there is how can we be better at exporting solar electricity out of Arizona into other parts of the country where they consume it. Of course, you have to make sure the transmission lines are there. We also found in the same discussion, though, there's 1.5 gigawatts of flat rooftop space just in Phoenix. Right? So we can play both sides of the equation. What it isn't, you can't turn it on at any given moment and know with ultimate certainty that the supply will be there if a cloud goes by, as an example. So this is a big obstacle that's leading a lot of the discussion now about research into storage, as an example. Right? A little bit about my view, especially on smart grid energy net opportunities. Energy nets is a technique we've been thinking of for a while now. But if you think about the United States and the challenges that we have, what utilities are often worried about, this is meant to be a map sort of superimposed over the United States with all the different energy options sort of part of the big smart grid, if you will. As clouds and weather go from one part of the country to another, we can get quite good at forecasting the impact that's going to have on the distribution infrastructure, circulation of clean electricity. So smart grid in that sense really helps us get good at planning for those types of changes in energy output for optimization, very critical. But it's also based on a traditional distribution infrastructure, right? So in the energy net sense, the only concept here is that if you think about solar as a wireless power supply, to borrow from the Photocom ads of some while ago, you can think about deploying solar off-grid or on-grid in ways that allow you to extend the use of solar far beyond the current markets, which are residential, commercial, and utilities. So in that sense, just a couple of examples. I think these are phenomenal things we should never forget about. Solar is a variable power supply. There are companies, this is SolarBee as an example, that takes solar modules, works with municipalities, so during the day when they have sunshine, the solar power is treating the waste stream. When the sun is not plentiful enough, there's a utility backup. But usually this type of application doesn't care whether there's variable output because the DC motors will still turn. So it can reduce the load on the grid. I think it's quite an interesting. It's still a small market, but if you add up all the municipality requirements across the United States, it's an enormous number. It can be applied to other things, which we're doing now in farming. New ways to think about transport. This is something near and dear to BP, as you might imagine. Some of the statistics are pretty phenomenal if you think about truly optimizing this. There's no particular reason why this has to be a residence, right? Most people park their cars at work every day. If we start to attack this market segment, you can charge your car while you're at work. This is a favorite of mine. A lot of the lighting systems across the United States already have storage. There is no particular reason why you can't add solar to the mix. And use solar for the grid when there's more than you need for the lights. But the batteries will be there when the lights are off. Each individual application is small, but adds up collectively to be quite a big consumer of energy. What I like about these things, though, it's a way to bring in more people to the clean tech discussion than you have with a narrow focus on smart grid, as an example, right? Because it's a small collection of the large opportunity. And this sort of reflects what the larger opportunities might be. A lot of these programs in Germany, as an example, there's whenever you go to incentive schemes to grow a market, how do you get more people to participate so there's less friction about how you structure the incentives? If we can include more people in the journey, there's less friction. Summary, as you heard today already, good local market growth leads to jobs. There's no reason to focus per se other than we need the scale to continue to drive the cost down, but let's use that benefit across multiple markets and use the technology's natural attributes. Thank you all very much.
Our next speaker, Mark Pinto, is not only the Chief Technology Officer for Applied Material, but also General Manager for Energy and Environmental Solutions. So I think he has as good a visibility as anybody over where the new capacity is going up around the world.
Thanks. So first, for those of you who don't know, Applied Materials, we're a 40-year-old company, have been the leader in semiconductor equipment manufacturing. We actually, in the early 90s, entered the flat panel display market and now are the largest maker of equipment for the LCD, TV, and monitor industry. And 5 years ago, started efforts around equipment and manufacturing solutions for energy. And specifically today, we make equipment for both wafer and thin film based modules. Interesting evolution. Over the past 12 months, our revenue in this area, the energy area, is almost $1 billion out of $7.4 billion. So this has been a very rapidly growing business, one which we've invested fairly significantly. Our products cross even into the flexible substrates. So our background is from the Moore's Law kind of perspective, the learning curve perspective. And I think it's very instrumental in learning where this industry might go. So this is Moore's, I think, one of his last versions of this in 2003, showing that transistors have gone from a dollar to almost a nanodollar today. And you can correlate that to an iPod, $200, if you made it in 1976, would be $1 billion. So that's the kind of power of the learning curve. Of course, VLSI is pretty unique in the orders of magnitude that we've been able to deliver there. But that's come with huge amounts of spending and growing amounts of spending. And I know John Kelly will probably address this after lunch in terms of how the industry has been able to afford to make this happen. But that money is well returned in terms of the revenue and the productivity that's been enabled in the products. What underlies that is cost per function, cost per, in the case of ICs, cost per transistor, or cost per bit. And a lot of the lessons we learned there can be applied to other industries. You can subdivide that into two things: a process cost, how much does it cost you to process something per area, and how much value do you get out per unit area. In ICs, that's transistor. How many transistors do you get? That's Moore's Law. Crunch them in there, and you lower the cost. For solar, it's watts. How many watts do you get out? And there's a number of things that go into that. So what have we learned from that? First, these kinds of technologies, we like to call them nanomanufacturing technologies, have underlied the progress in ICs and flat panel displays over the past 40 years. They've driven down the cost and made possible adoption of consumer products where cost is very, very sensitive. Secondly, demand waves have been critical to continued investment and progress. You look at the IC, it started with the government, the missiles, went to information technology, the computers, went to the mobile technology. In displays, it started with the laptop, moved to the monitor, now it's the TV. Those things have driven the continued investment and progress. They've had different cost points that they've had to meet and made this investment worthwhile. Some level of standardization was important to gain critical mass. It's not necessarily, in this case, we have the CMOS underpinning of the technology. It's not necessarily the case in solar. There's going to be a diversity of technologies. That's okay. There are other ways to find standardization to help gain critical mass. Some of it, we hope, will be, for instance, in equipment and that can be applied across multiple platforms. One major difference with integrated circuits, although very similar to flat panel displays, which is how we got into this, is that integrated circuits is dominated by that blue circle. How many transistors can you cram? Most other applications have a more of a balance between these two cost factors. In fact, things like architectural glass and flat panel displays are driven by the numerator. What's your process cost per unit area? And to drive that down, you need large area equipment typically, big pieces of equipment to really get the throughput and get the cost, unit cost down. And then last, factory sites do not necessarily imply manufacturing technology ownership. That's true of SunPower, it's true of First Solar, who site their factories worldwide. It's true of Applied Materials. We supply equipment all around the world. So solar has a learning curve. And in fact, you look back in 1980, there's been constant progress to today. There was a little bump recently in the poly shortage. That's now coming down, as the prior speakers have talked about. The issue was when Jimmy Carter said we should be 20% solar by the year 2000 in 1979, equivalent electricity cost was over $1 a kilowatt hour. That's a far gap to make in terms of policy. Just no way that gap could be crossed. But thanks to the work done around the world, that these costs have come down. In addition, we're seeing the onset of these thin film technologies, which have even lower production costs. Of course, they have to compensate for the fact for lower efficiency, which means lower balance of systems cost, maybe on average 12 cents a watt per percentage of efficiency. That difference can make a big difference in terms of cost parity in things like utility scale markets. Factory scale has changed pretty dramatically and more rapidly so in the past few years. ARCO Solar in 1980 had the world's, I believe, first 1 megawatt per year factory. It took 20 years to get to 10 megawatts. There are going to be factories that can do a gigawatt in the next couple years. So this has been a major factor. We've learned this in integrated circuits and flat panel displays as well. So almost a 10x cost reduction has been achieved. Demand initiatives have been behind that. I'm going to echo what the previous speakers have said. In Japan and Europe, there's been continuous innovation and learning and manufacturing scale, like this factory example. And one key thing is the world didn't wait for a miracle here. It's been constant investment. And that's one of a theme that we see across multiple industries. It's not you'll get passed by if you just stay on the sidelines. It doesn't mean you shouldn't invest in breakthroughs, constant investment and manufacturing scale can make huge steps. So let's turn to some data and some more specifics. So in crystalline silicon wafer manufacturing, here is, and this is, I intentionally picked October to be more provocative, also as the resize plans are a little more difficult to judge. But if you looked back in October, this was our customers' plans for wafering technology on the left and cells on the right. And you can see the comment before of all the polysilicon plants and wafering in China, that's almost 50% of what was going to be the added capacity. Very little in the United States. On the cell capacity, again, a growing percentage in China, very small sliver in the U.S. And by the way, I did this by headquartered companies, not by where they were going to site the plant. It would probably be even more dramatic if we used the siting of the plants. The keys to crystalline silicon manufacturing, thin wafers, slicing wafers very, very thin with low loss. Material science, interfaces on the nanoscale really matter. High throughput tools. This is a PVD system. In silicon, we're used to tens of wafers in an hour. This is 3,000 wafers an hour that go through the silicon nitride deposition. And not to be overlooked, this is a very key point, is manufacturability and factory control. And if you're not careful, you can go to higher efficiency but get a much wider spread in your factory output, which makes the whole factory investment in terms of the number of watts you get out per year not quite what you had in mind. The only way this is going to work is you've got to tighten your distribution or keep it tight as you move the efficiency up, and that's been a challenge for the industry. Giving you another example specifically from our thin film products where we're building garage door size panels to really try and lower production cost and installation cost. We started this in 2007. We now have 14 projects worldwide. We have 5 sites now in production over that 2-year period. You can see the black dots where all of them are. I didn't cut off California on purpose. I can tell you there's no black dot behind there. So 3 in China, 1 in Taiwan, 1 in India, 1 in Abu Dhabi, and the rest in Europe. Some highlights, one of the first ones was in India, a company called Moser Bear, who wants to go after the local market there. One we announced is in production this week with tandem junction technology, higher efficiency on those big panels in Germany. A joint venture between a German glass company and E.ON, the European utility, where they're focusing primarily on building integrated photovoltaics, the Masdar effort in Abu Dhabi, and an interesting effort in Italy where it's a wind provider who's going to combine solar and wind together in the same projects. And then some large projects as well in China. One of the things where this is going to go is these large factories. So just to give you a feel what a large factory is going to look like, a gigawatt thin film factory, the kind we would make, would consume 500 tons of glass a day. It would be sited about on the land that the Magic Kingdom is in Disney World, and it would produce 7.5 football fields full of glass a day. One message from this is we believe eventually these will be sited where glass will be or where the building material will be consumed. So it will come. It's a question of when to the U.S. Scale matters. This kind of scale gives you a 20% cost reduction, which is equivalent to 1 year earlier grid parity or more than a 1% module efficiency increase. So by making scale, you can drive down the learning curve all by itself. Not to brag, but this is the top 10 PV cell and module equipment suppliers as ranked by VLSI Technology. My only point of this is we're kind of alone. So the rest is mostly European and Japanese with a number of Chinese suppliers also. This is only cell and module. It doesn't include the wafering, which we have a very big position in. So what could help grow U.S. PV manufacturing? Going to sound boring, but there's no question it's demand is the key. If there was one thing, it's demand. I would start by talking about accounting for the true future cost. One of the things I find frustrating is when you talk to utilities, they think about their current model. They don't think about where the utility may go, smart grids, as Eric talked about. The value of solar in time of day and time of year when electricity, marginal electricity prices are expensive, when you're using peaking plants. The fossil fuel cost uncertainties. One of the things Europe did in their feed-in tariffs is they included the hedged value of the fluctuation of oil prices. That's typically not done here. That's an important aspect, and if nothing else, we should have learned that in the last 12 to 24 months. The cost of carbon that's going to come, and the value of distributed power. PV solar has a very unique advantage in that you can build it into any scale in any location on the grid, essentially, whether it's on a house, in a field, or in the desert. That makes it very much more flexible to apply around the grid and should lower total costs. Another aspect of cost is to do multi-year generation contracts. When you're on something as steep a learning curve as we're on, if you average something over the next 5 years, you get a significantly lower average cost of panels for the next 5 years. So that's a way to get started, not to take today's price. Look at the price over the next 5 years when you make commitments. Utilities make commitments to nuclear plants that take 10 years to build. Here's a way to look at things a little differently and forward price how these modules are going to be as they're used. Progressive and enforceable renewable energy electricity standards. Not to wait until 2019 to all of a sudden try and catch up. This is a way of just putting things off. We need targets and we need to make them progressive. An appropriate cost mechanism for carbon. Refundability of renewable credits. We have many customers who if there was a market in the U.S., would have the willingness to invest in factories. They won't make money right away. as they invest. So having a tax credit is not necessarily that helpful to them, but on an ongoing basis to be able to apply that. And then finally, a clean energy bank for low interest loans on solar. This is not just about investing in solar factories or investing in solar power plants. Solar is a capital good. Even if you put it on your house, you have to lay out the money ahead of time. So in all of these analyses, when you see levelized cost of electricity, there's an assumed interest rate in there. If you make that interest rate, the prevailing interest rate that you can get from a bank, the economics change dramatically. If you put in 8.5%, the rate of return of a utility, the levelized cost goes up significantly. If you put in something even higher than that to a power producer that produces the power to sell it to the utility, you're going to add a whole bunch of financing in there, and that makes solar more expensive. And by the way, just to say, we practice what we preach. We have a 2-megawatt system in our campus in California, sun power based modules. You can see the parking lot and the buildings. However, that only supplies 5% of the electricity on that site. On the manufacturing and R&D side, renewable manufacturing incentives. Germany did both. Germany did the demand side, and they funded manufacturing incentives. So one of our first customers for our thin film factory is a U.S. It's an Indian national investors based in the U.S. with a factory in Germany, because the incentives in Germany. And just to also reinforce, I think collaborative government, university, and industry R&D with the appropriate balance of evolution and high risk and disruption. I think there are things we can learn from Semitech, IMEC, the Semiconductor Research Corporation, SRC, with universities, we believe has been a very good model. It's not to say that any one of those models fits. You know, I take Semitech as an example, assume certain things were pre-competitive, about that there's a roadmap, a common technology roadmap. That's not necessarily true. The same things aren't true of solar. We have to adapt these things for these specific situations. So with that, thank you very much, and look forward to talking to you more during the day. I should say I left one slide out. I like this quote from the New York Times in 1981, not 2009. So I think now is really the time. Thanks.
Thank you. Next speaker, Stephen Freeland, the Chief Technology Officer of DuPont Electronics and Communication Technology. So can discuss, right? Okay. go ahead.
I'm one of the fortunate people who manages to hold down two jobs in DuPont. Most of the director of material science and engineering and central research and development. When you're sixth in line amongst a group of speakers, many of whom have similar business models sharing an industry, it's always a challenge to figure out what's left to say when you have such notable speakers as we've heard. I tried to take a little bit of a different approach here in what I'm going to present to you. But one of the things that I did anticipate was the question of what's DuPont doing in the PV space. We are far back in the value in the supply chain, in the value chain as a materials supplier. So let me talk a little bit about the company. Our goal as a company has essentially remained unchanged for the last 206 years, and that's to be the most dynamic science company in the world, providing solutions that make people's lives better. And one of the ways that you keep that fresh is by focusing on, and in some cases when you can get lucky, creating the megatrends in the world. Whether it's the early 19th century and the expansion of the young U.S. westward with the need for gunpowder and explosives to build the country, or today's megatrends of the unprecedented growth in developing countries that leads to an increased need in efficiency in food production and obviously renewable energies such as photovoltaics. So this is the kind of thinking that informs DuPont's general R&D and production directions. Now, DuPont has actually been in the photovoltaics industry since its very beginning. The first so-called solar battery that was produced at Bell Labs, I believe in 1955, used DuPont UltraPure silicon. we were in the silicon business at that time. And I must say, having just spoken about megatrends, it's a little bit depressing to recognize that we decided that that was not a good business for us. We don't get them all right. But in today's industry, we are, like Dow Corning, an industry leader in many of the critical materials that are upstream of the cells and the modules that you've been hearing about for the rest of the morning. And in fact, our bailiwick is in those non-silicon containing materials, in things like the top sheets, front sheets, encapsulants, engineering resins, and processing chemicals. While we continue to generate new and improved materials in the crystalline silicon space, we actually believe that thin film PV is a tremendous opportunity, not just for DuPont materials, but also for the industry. And I'm going to take a little bit of a different approach here than what you've heard. I'm going to talk about something very specific, which is thin film PV on flexible substrates, because my feeling is PV on flex creates an entitlement for thin films in that it opens up new applications and potentially whole new markets for photovoltaics. But thin film also represents some extraordinary materials challenges. And just I'll give you a couple of examples here. In order to get to this thin film on flex, obviously we need to replace the rigid components of a module. That requires a flexible, durable, protective front sheet that has a very, very low water vapor transmission rate, competitive with the performance of glass. Now, from a polymer perspective, this is essentially unheard of. And yet, one of the pieces of work that we're currently doing in my laboratories and central research is to develop a polymer system with a very thin 30 nanometer thick coating that, if you look at laboratory results for 85 degrees C, 85% relative humidity, with this material as the front sheet on a SIGS thin film cell, copper indium gallium diselenide, very, very moisture sensitive material, and compare the efficiency over time, what you see is that the material that we're working on in the lab in blue is essentially competitive with glass. Compare that to the polymer by itself, and the degradation of the performance is a function of time. Laboratory results, but very, very exciting, and asking an awful lot out of a polymer system. One of the other exciting potentials of thin film on flex is the ability to do very low-cost roll-to-roll manufacturing with monolithic integration. Now, one of the things that's been found, again, just focusing on copper indium gallium diselenide, and this has been found by a number of laboratories, I quote some work out of University of Delaware, as a function of temperature of deposition, you get tremendous increases in the efficiency. So being able to get 5-6% absolute efficiency gain through increasing temperature is a very exciting thing. But to have a flexible substrate, like a polymer, that can survive at 500 to 600 degrees centigrade and match the coefficient of thermal expansion that you have in a thin film system, extremely difficult, virtually unheard of. So in order to develop these kinds of materials, we are not going to be able to depend on evolutionary or incremental improvements in existing polymer systems. This is going to take radical new materials and radical new processes. And as you've heard a couple of speakers before describe, the investment for doing something like that is quite substantial. Now, there's another common thread through these two programs that I want to emphasize. And that is that both of these are being done in collaboration with partners, either universities or national laboratories. And this concept of open innovation has really been a part of how DuPont does its research for the last 100 years or so, where we recognize that while we have a strong and vital research facility ourselves, we cannot possibly have all of the best people in a field. And so we have to reach out to our large and small company partners, but also tremendous opportunities for interacting with national laboratories and universities. It's critically important that the government understands that funding of small companies, universities, and government laboratories is critical to the lifeblood of large companies. This concept of open innovation becomes increasingly important when we're in a rapidly moving industry such as photovoltaics. Rapidly moving industries actually have some very interesting challenges in and of themselves. Tautologically, when technology and markets are moving very, very quickly, the pace of technology change is very high, and that means the change in investment is very high, and investment becomes obsolete in a relatively quick order. I'd like to give you a little bit of a cautionary tale that some of you in the audience have participated in, I'm sure, and that's in the display industry. I'm just going to show quickly some data here from 2005. This is what the market share for various display technologies looked like, where you have liquid crystal displays, CRTs, plasma displays, and rear projection. So you're looking at it as a function of size of panel. Well, what's happened since 2005? Well, you can see that at that point, plasma was sort of squeezed in between a little bit of LCD, CRT, and rear projection. Since then, plasma has been pushed further and further out, which has basically pushed rear projection off of the chart. What has been pushing plasma is liquid crystal technology. Well, the investment in every one of these technologies mounts into the billions of dollars per fabrication unit. And yet the market is shifting very, very quickly. As consumers change what they're after in terms of size, prices change, technologies change. And meanwhile, while you'll say, okay, it's over, there is the ascendancy now of liquid crystal displays. Up here in the upper left corner, you find OLED. And in a couple of years, we're going to start seeing this thing happening all over again. So the cautionary tale here is that PV, with all of its different technology options, has the potential of doing something very similar. From a material supplier standpoint, there's a tremendous disincentive when you have this kind of change in markets and change in technologies to do truly revolutionary, innovative work. We can do it, but the investment is so great, and the rate of return is going to be dependent on the longevity of technologies such as this, that you're not going to see that kind of innovation that you need. And instead, you're going to see this incremental change of existing materials and technologies. This is an area where government support to de-risk R&D in these areas is incredibly important. And if you think of this sort of graphically, the materials industry is absolutely wonderful in managing places where there's a large market uncertainty, a good rate of change, but only a moderate change in technology. Government labs, universities, and industry research organizations are very good when the technology is embryonic, high rate of change, and the market is actually embryonic and just beginning. Where government support and the consortia are extremely important is in this area where both are hot. One of the organizations that manages this extremely well, I believe, is DARPA. Because DARPA will set out a challenge, will bring people together in what is essentially an ad hoc consortium. And I use here as an example the very high-efficient solar cell program that DARPA initiated a number of years ago. DuPont is now the prime contractor of that. We're working with up to 13 different organizations, depending upon the time of the program, both industry, small and large, and academic and government laboratories, going against a very clear target where there is financial support, not only through the invention stage, but all the way through development, prototyping, and the early stage of manufacturing as part of the plan. So DARPA has done a nice job in this, in making sure that the consortium is put together, bringing us all together against the same challenge, and making sure that the funding is there and supporting the work through to the end. Another place where where there's a way of controlling this fast-moving technology and fast-moving markets is through what a number of people have mentioned up to this point already, which is road mapping. The reason why road mapping works, I think, is well exemplified by the ITRS roadmap for the semiconductor industry. And I'll just show you one example out of this where DuPont has played. For the 65 nanometer half pitch in semiconductors, just thinking about the lithography portion of it, there are a number of technologies, five in particular of note, that could have been explored, were being explored, around 2000 to 2003. By 2004, one of them had entirely dropped out, 157 nanometer note, but that still left four technologies. What the ITRS roadmap was able to do is to lay out the objectives for each of these technologies, what the performance needed to be, what each step along the way needed to be to make it happen, and what the timing had to be. Why is that important to a material supplier? Well, if you can understand, pardon me, all of that, you can understand when the stench of death lays heavy over your research program. And it may be that you're doing fine, but the roadmap makes it very clear that there is some other important component to success that isn't happening on a time scale. And since everybody is working off the same page, everybody understands the same things, pardon me, everybody understands the same things about what, where the industry is going, what it needs, when, why, and how much, you can address the failures at the capital R, little d phase, or at a minimum, at the little r, capital D phase, before there's this tremendous investment. So let me close with some final thoughts that are hopefully going to be a little bit different than what you've heard up to this point around what role the government can play. I've talked mostly about this issue of supporting high-risk R&D, how you can close that value, the valley of death between the R&D and the investment and what could be done there. I want to emphasize again that within this issue of R&D, support for universities and government labs is important, not only because of the technology, but because certainly at the university level, universities represent important feeders of people as well. And the people are not just U.S. nationals. We need to make sure that the programs to continue to have good flows of visas for people so we can get the best people in the world working in U.S. industry to make these kinds of developments. But the issue of policy and incentive is one that I haven't really talked about up to this point. They represent that line between them sort of represents the driving of behavior that you've heard others speak of before. I like to think about these incentives and policies as being kinetically important. I apologize, I'm a physical organic chemist by training. They're kinetically important because they can really jumpstart the industry. They keep things flowing at the early embryonic stages. But they cannot be thermodynamically important. The industry itself has to be self-sustaining. We want to make sure that we don't put things in place that, if pulled out, either through budgetary reasons or any other governmental rationale, will sink the industry. It has to stand on its own, and all incentives have to be designed towards that. And of course, one of those things that can start is to provide that base load of a market. The government obviously is a huge buyer. The government can also set price floors, as it has in other industries, that allow the investments to be done with a fairly good appreciation for where the market is going to go. Even with a company as large as DuPont, we are constantly having to make decisions about programs at the margins. And often, it's the high-risk, even potentially high-reward programs that drop off because of the level of uncertainty. And government incentives, both in terms of market size and in supporting the industries, that clear support can go a long way to helping industries make the right decision about those programs on one side or the other of that very gray line. Thank you very much.
We're already a little bit late, so let's. We have time for some questions, right, Chuck?
Sure.
Yeah, great.
Could I ask one?
Yeah.
For the last speaker, Steve, what level of R&D support is needed? And related to that, are the advances that we see in some of our Asian friends and competitors due to substantially lower cost of capital for the entire value chain? So first, when someone says they need R&D support, if a Senate staffer asks, well, what level of R&D support do you need? And this idea of monetizing taxes that was raised by tax credits that was raised by Mark would be something to explore.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's almost an impossible question to answer, because level of support is going to be dependent on the particular technology that's being pursued and the particular need. I think the question really should be about what point do you bring in that support. If you bring it in the early stage of R&D, it's not entirely clear to me that it's going to be necessarily as effective as it would be if you can say that you're carrying out the support through that really difficult area, which is jumping from what I've done in the lab, getting it out into prototyping. And that tends to be much more expensive. That's also the point at which most companies really start to perk up their ears and pay attention to what's going on. So I think rather than being able to address specifics about how much, really about when and where in the process.
Yes. Hi, I'm Santosh Krenik from Rochester Institute of Technology, currently working at IBM on a sabbatical on photovoltaics. My question is that even though sunlight is infinite and silicon is abundant, how are we dealing with materials sustainability with respect to silver or indium or other materials which are being used in photovoltaics?
I'll field that one. It's obviously something that we keep very close tabs on, and a fair bit of the research was designed to make sure that we're not living in the past with the materials. We continue to work on, you asked about silver and indium. Challenge for indium is more from the display industry at the amount that's used there at this point in solar. But we recognize that alternatives to indium found particularly in the thin film area, and that's an area of active research for us. There's another piece of this as well, though. Polymers that I talked about largely are derived from fossil fuels. And so there's another issue of sustainability here that we are keenly aware of, have a great deal of making sure that every opportunity that you have to develop a new polymer brings with it an opportunity to develop a polymer based on materials.
Hi, my name is Mike Heedman. I'm at the University of Toledo. I have a question that relates to this panel, but also to the previous one, and perhaps relates to the question, the first question asked in this question period about how does the level of investment compare in the, say, in the U.S. versus overseas? Well, in China, for instance, it seems like, you know, energy costs are essentially free, and land costs are essentially free. And we're concerned about where these jobs are going to go and whether or not investments made here will just be resulting in jobs in China. I wonder if the cap and trade mechanism is one way to kind of levelize the playing field. So it's not a protectionist approach, but it says that we're going to include in the cost of the manufacturing process the cost of the emitted CO2. And currently, you know, the cost of electricity generation in China with respect to CO2 emissions is a lot lower than it is here, for instance. So I don't know if anybody could have an answer to that question, or is more of a comment, I guess.
I think the carbon content in photovoltaics is not that large, so the issue is more, you know, on coal plants in China and instituting cap and trade here, not doing it in a reciprocal way, could be, you know, more of the issue there. I think it's especially true with thin film technology, coal and ingot. They have low utility usage, and so it's not. It's not a very big carbon penalty.
If I might add, I believe where we more protect this today and other countries are consumed at great volume, where we do have had protectionist policies elsewhere in the world do not exist to the extent this today. And having lived through that debate in many countries, I'm not real keen on protectionist policy, just because of you know, where and how our industry has grown and will likely continue to grow. In terms of the opportunity we have to shape what is consumed and built in the United States, the U.S. has been the leader in the design of the products that are sold today, the certifications, the safety standard, the longevity, the materials that go into it, all really originated from policy and R&D work in the United States. And if we keep that in mind, I think we have a great opportunity to shape how stuff comes to the U.S., which ultimately brings where it's made.
Okay. I just have a time, just a quick question. There, we've all been writing about China's massive investments in the last 5 or so years in wafer fabs. Many, many more than I think the bulk of the world in China. But recently, during the downturn, I just saw a really alarming report by iSupply about how the entire Chinese it was not just a matter of incredible overcapacity, 60% under 60% underutilized capacity, but also analysis that the whole drive in China into the foundry business has kind of flopped, and just questioning the entire business model, and it's looking, almost a disaster. China and all this capacity though can be used for solar, doesn't require the 12-inch wafers, those line widths. I'm just wondering, one, does this tell you, how would you compare China's progress in the solar panel and cell business? Is it a potential to see huge overinvestment in technologies that are not quite state-of-the-art and are not going to be really globally competitive going into the future? Or is this going to be, is this experience different? Companies like SunTech seem to be doing very, very well, and it's also their process technology, manufacturing. So then that's one question, is it different? The second is, this capacity, what is it going to do to the economic of other technologies, such as thin film, as you try to get down to with a big market, and this is where China seems to be in an almost own market. So just two questions. Mark, I don't expect you to criticize your customers in China, but if you what we're seeing.
No, so I think in solar, there has been in China. What's startling about it, I think, is that the local Chinese demand, I think the U.S. is almost nothing. Number, third-party estimate I used 2007, China installed 20 megawatts of solar. We installed 2 megawatts by materials, so doesn't sound right. But there's a lot of capacity there. So if they wanted to turn on domestic demand in their own way, they could absorb it really extremely quick. So use the number ratio to Belgium, China, and they need the power. So cleaner environment. In terms of the technology, no, I don't. Cost per watt is key, and manufacturing efficiency and scale can get you that cost. And that SunTech is proving that. So, I would also say SunTech is a thin film customer, so they're looking at this both ways. I think chasing right now the market that's there, which is Europe, Germany, and in Spain, I think that the lines can be upgraded to higher efficiency. One of the challenges is how do you do that and uniformity. That's another bigger thing. Another one is a lot of lines to be more competitive going forward have to use wafers, and there may be upgrades or changes in that. But as long as they can drive the scale and the cost, they can be successful. This is a market that's about manufacturing cost and cost. It's not foundry industry for ICs, which depends on property from the person who uses the foundry, very different model. I don't think there's a parallel there.
Thanks. We have to break now, and thanks for a great panel.
Could I ask you to say,